Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. What happens to your brain when you play a video game? And do different games affect us in different ways? We'll be talking about that with our guest, C. Sean Green. Sean is in the studio with me. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at UW-Madison. He's been doing some really interesting research on video games and brain function. So, what interests you about, or maybe what concerns you about video games? Are you a gamer? What effects has it had on you? Or maybe what effects has it had on your children? Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at our Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also tweet us at L. Mealer Show. And Sean Green, welcome.
Ah, thanks for having me here.
Well, it's great to have you. Great to have you with us today. First, before we get talking about your research, you're part of the Learning and Transfer Lab at UW. Tell us about that lab.
Correct. That's the name of my lab in the psychology department.
Hold on a second. We're having some trouble with your microphone, so I'm going to ask you to switch mics, and let's see if we can get you onto a different mic here. All right. Let's see how we're doing here.
Sure. So the Learning and Transfer Lab is the name of my lab in psychology at UW-Madison. Our interest is, as the name indicates, we're interested in human learning, and in particular, how do we produce human learning that transfers to other skills. So one thing that we know in human learning is that it's very easy to get good at one very specific task, but often then that doesn't generalize to other things. So for instance, you know, if you do lots of Sudoku, you'll get really good at Sudoku, but you're not necessarily good at other things that require planning. If you do lots of crosswords, you might get very good at crosswords, but you're not good at other things that require linguistic skills.
So that's kind of interesting to me, and I was looking at one of your videos that you have online, and you were talking about how people, if they can learn to see very, very small differences in between how two lines may or may not be lined up if they're, say, perpendicular, but you can teach them to be very good at it. But then if you put the lines horizontally, they have to learn it all over again, basically.
Correct. You know, there's even cases where, you know, you teach someone to make very fine visual discriminations with their left eye, so you patch their right eye, and then all you do is ask them to do the task with their right eye, and you see no generalization across the eyes. So we call this specificity of learning, and it's a real obstacle if you want to use behavioral training to produce real-world impact, where it kind of necessitates that you can generalize it to new situations out in the world.
Very interesting. What got you interested in video games and brain function and the effects on them? It's really cool stuff, actually.
Sure. Serendipity, quite frankly. the lab that I joined as an undergraduate, I did my undergraduate at the University of Rochester in New York, was run by Daphne Bavelier, who continues to be a collaborator of mine. And her research interest was in the effects of congenital deafness on vision. The idea that if you are born deaf, well, say there's a whole host of brain areas that are expecting auditory input that aren't receiving auditory input. Yeah. So what do they do? And so her interest was in the possibility that those brain areas might be utilized for visual functions. And so in joining that lab, I was given the task of designing an experiment that we were going to test on congenitally deaf individuals and non-deaf individuals. And I piloted it on a host of my friends. And this was a test that had really well-known norms. You know, we kind of knew how people should behave. And I brought the data, I was maybe 19 at the time, to my advisor. And all of these people were way off scale. And of course, the first thing that an advisor thinks when a 19-year-old brings them bad data is that the undergraduate messed up. But upon confirming that wasn't the case, we started to ask, well, how do the people that I happen to have chosen differ from what the norms are? And, you know, this was in the late 90s. It's when college campuses were starting to be fully networked with T1 lines. All of my friends happened to be playing one very active video game called Team Fortress Classic. That idea that it might be the video games that are producing these differences became my senior thesis, my graduate thesis and kind of all the way now to my research here at UW.
And it's really fascinating research. You know, there are so many different video games. My 14-year-old has games that she likes to play that some of them are really fast moving, some of them are pretty slow moving, to be perfectly honest, knowledge kinds of games. And they don't all affect the brain the same way, do they?
That's correct. It's kind of one of the first things that I start any talk with is, you know, often say when parents ask me a question, they'll say, well, what's the effect of video games on the brain? And kind of the first places to start is that video games is such a big category. It's not a particularly useful category. I like to use the analogy of it's asking what the effect of eating food is on the body, right? In the same way that it depends on what type of food and more specifically, what is the content of the food, proteins, carbohydrates, fats. The effects of video games depend on what type of video game, and more specifically, what's the content of the games? You know, how fast are they? What are the types of decisions you have to make? What's the storyline? You know, what's the content? And so we know there's really strong evidence that different types of games affect the brain in different ways, and the way that you would expect because they're different experiences.
So how do you conduct your studies?
So we do two types of studies. The first type of study we tend to do is kind of the natural experiment. There's lots of people who, as part of their daily lives, play certain types of video games and other people who don't play those games. So we can bring them, you know, those two groups of people into the lab and ask, well, is there a difference between the people who choose to play this type of game, say the action games that we tend to study, and people who don't play those games. So we do kind of the correlational or cross-sectional study. If we see a difference there, well, then we have to ask the question, is it the video games that are actually causing the change? You obviously have to worry that, well, maybe people who are just born with really good visual skills are attracted to playing games. And so it's not the act of playing the game that's leading to differences. It's just some natural effect. So we bring people who don't play action games specifically into the lab, and we train them, for say 50 hours.
How to play them.
How to play them. They play, many hours spaced over many months. And another group plays a different type of video game. So another entertainment game that's supposed to be just as fun. You identify with the character, but it doesn't have the kind of what we would call the mechanics and the dynamics, the content of the game that the action games have. And then we compare those two groups. How does their perception or their cognitive abilities change as a result of playing either, you know, a highly active game or a less active video game?
And what do you find?
So playing, you know, what we call these action games. So these are games that have lots of fast motion, lots of things to track simultaneously. We talk about lots of what we call clutter. So there's just a few important things on the screen and then lots of things that are basically just there to distract you. Often these are games that they call first-person shooters or third-person shooters. They're more or less as they sound. You're typically running around shooting enemies. And we find that playing that type of game as compared to other slower games like life simulation games such as The Sims, produces enhancements in kind of everything from very low-level visual skills, like just your ability to distinguish fine differences in level of gray. We call that contrast sensitivity. All the way up through pretty high-level things like your ability to mentally rotate objects in your mind or to multitask or to quickly switch between competing tasks.
Talking today with Sean Green about his interesting research on what video games do to your brain or your kids' brains or your grandkids' brains. I hope you'll join in with your own questions, comments, or experiences. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. So I'm wondering about those people that you tested who were not used to playing fast games, and then trained them to teach those games. Did you ever follow up with them to see if they became good at playing or continue to play those types of games?
We followed up people up to, say, 2 years later. There are some cases where they will continue to play them, but often, they're just not games that they like to play, so they don't continue playing them after being in the study. They basically treat it as part of the study. But there are certainly some individuals who learn that they do like playing them and then continue on. It's a mixed bag, I would say, in terms of who continues and who doesn't.
So, it's kind of focusing on kids here, but I know your research has application to a lot of different areas. I know Sue in Green Bay called to ask what games are good for seniors to play. And there's research out there that shows that video games can be useful to elderly folks in certain at least maybe many situations.
Correct. I think the way that we think about kind of what the value of video games are for, say, cognitive function is that they put your brain under what we call load. It's slightly more than what you can handle. And this is kind of an interesting point with regard to the elderly, because the games that we use in our college-age students tend to be much too difficult for elderly populations, both in terms of how fast they are and also just the motor requirements. You have to use kind of very fine motor requirements with your thumbs. And so the types of games that people have seen are valuable for older adults are different than the ones that they've tended to use with young adults. The research on elderly adults is focused more on games that we call real-time strategy games that don't have quite the need to make as fast motor responses, but can still put the system under load, especially kind of as the system naturally slows down with aging.
You talked, though, you have talked about how video games may help, for example, elderly in driving.
Yeah, so there's certainly some evidence to suggest that certain types of behavioral training, the ability to, training that allows you to, say, have better peripheral vision or to better pick out important targets in peripheral vision could have ramifications for driving ability. It tends to be the case that the types of, say, visual tests that you get at the DMV, like a simple eye chart, aren't super predictive of driving accidents. Most people don't run into things that they're staring right at and paying attention to.
It's those things that are kind of peripherally.
Peripheral, the ability to pick out, a car that's coming, at an intersection from amongst parked cars. Those are the types of skills that are more important for driving. And there's certainly groups who have tried to use behavioral training using much more simplistic types of video games specifically to improve driving in older adults.
Interesting. Well, we have some callers online who want to visit with you. Just a reminder, our visitor today, an expert, Sean Green, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about video games and what they can do to brain function with our guest, Professor Sean Green from the UW-Madison. 1-800-642-1234. That's the number to call if you have a question or comment. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jeremy in Appleton will give you a chance to join in. Hi, thank you for calling.
For taking my call. I really appreciate it. I just had a quick question for your guest today.
Yeah.
I'm the parent of a 7-year-old son who has autism spectrum disorder and is relatively high functioning, but as he's getting older, he is having more interest in the idea of playing video games, typically from some of his peers. So I'm curious to ask your guest about his opinion or perspective on kind of the effect of video game play on children with autism spectrum in particular as they grow up.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, so I would say there's not a ton of explicit research on that question. I know that there's research suggesting that children with autism spectrum disorder tend to disproportionately enjoy video games, even above and beyond children without that diagnosis. But in terms of the ramifications, I think it's just not something that's known right now. It tends to be the case that, the mental and physical demands that are in the video games actually can be attractive to individuals with autism spectrum disorder because of, say, the repetition or the flashing lights, some of those things. But what the effects are, we're kind of in a place where, you know, we're still exploring all of the effects. And one thing that makes doing the research really difficult is that the games change so rapidly that research that we did 5 years ago, no one plays those games anymore.
Yeah.
And so understanding how the new games affect cognitive function based on the previous ones is something that's just really difficult.
Yeah. You have done some work on, or there has been some work done on children with dyslexia, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. There's a group in Italy that has spent a lot of time looking at the effect of actually playing the same types of games that I study in my lab, the action games, on dyslexia. Dyslexia is a kind of a high-level category. There's lots of subtypes, but basically it's an age-inappropriate ability to read. And so the group in Italy's argument is that the front end of the reading system is the visual system. And there's actually a lot of peripheral vision in reading. You don't fixate every single letters with your eyes. You actually kind of read off to the right in peripheral vision. There's also a lot of clutter, right? You need to pay attention to the letters that are in line, but not the one that's above or below.
Yeah.
And so it has some similarities. And so this group in Italy has shown that playing this type of game improves some aspects of reading. I would say that that research in terms of its clinical relevance is still, you know, to be determined, but they have several papers now showing that there are these benefits.
Yeah, so there's something out there. Jeremy, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerry in Park Falls, we turn to you next. Hi, Jerry. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a lot in common with Jeremy. I also have a son on the spectrum disorder. He's 10. My issues, he's into the Minecraft and the build from scratch games, you know, kind of, you know, where he's in control of what's going on and how it happens. My issues with it, it's becoming more of an addiction, and it's kind of run more into his everyday, you know, play. Everything is some sort of a role play that has to do with a video game, Mario, Sonic, you know, things of that nature.
Yep.
For all of his extra play is something incorporated with video games, including everything he draws, builds, with his toys and whatnot else. And that's kind of the issue that we're dealing with. And we're kind of looking at, you know, other ways of kind of weaning off of that and bringing him back into reality. I was wondering if you had anything on that.
Yeah. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. So for sure. You know, the idea of video game addiction, which, you know, has lots of scientific labels. So in the United States right now, I think it's labeled internet gaming disorder. Other places will call it problem gaming. The World Health Organization just identified it as a disorder. I'd say the major thing that's important with respect to video game addiction or problem gaming is that in order for it to be considered an addiction, there has to be real life negative ramifications. So often when parents are concerned about it, they're just concerned about the time that's being spent. You know, my child is spending lots of time playing video games. And so then the question is, are they suffering any real life harms? Are they not playing with other friends or doing other social behavior? Are they not doing their homework? Are they giving up sleep? Are they not eating? Are they ruminating over video games? These types of things we would tend to think of as symptoms of video game addiction. And once people start showing that type of behavior, there's increasingly the belief in the clinical community that some type of intervention is necessary in that case. You know, once the behaviors move to real life negative ramifications on life, it's not just that the child is enjoying playing games, that they're playing lots of games, but they're suffering in some way, their life is negatively being impacted, then that's the time to try to intervene and to say reduce the game playing.
Yeah. All right, so, Jerry, I appreciate your call very much. Just to go along with this, BJ emailed, and I think it's an example of what you were talking about here, in terms of video game addiction. Thought to be addiction to dopamine. Their son has played video games in excess for probably 15 years. He didn't work to his potential in high school. He flunked out of college and has now lost his marriage, all at least partly due to his gaming.
Yep. So you'll certainly see stories like that. In the same way, you know, often the story is very similar to what you would see in other behavioral addictions. So gambling addiction, for instance. In particular with gaming, one thing that tends to be recognized as a symptom is spending more money than you actually have to spend. So there's lots of games now that allow you to spend real world money for video game items, you know, things like houses, you know, kind of purely kind of material types of things, or else things that actually improve your ability to play the game, you know, better weapons, these types of things. And so one symptom that tends to show up on most classification schemes is spending too much money or damaging relationships of that type. You know, that's certainly consistent with the types of behaviors that a clinician, I should say I'm not a clinician, would recognize as being kind of pathological or video game addiction.
Hmm. Sean Green, our guest, as we talk with him about what video games do to brain function, look forward to hearing from you. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Tom in Madison called to ask if video games can help deter or would be useful with dementia patients.
So there's certainly a lot of interest in that. You know, in the idea kind of all the way through kind of natural and pathological aging. You know, I think dementia is another kind of very high-level category where there's lots of subtypes. And so depending on what the underlying etiology is, gaming could be more or less helpful. But in general, I think the idea that a more cognitively engaged lifestyle tends to be associated with more graceful aging, I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that games can be part of that. What we tend to caution people against is making games the only part of that.
Yeah.
So for instance, you know, another real key indicator of kind of graceful cognitive aging is social experiences. And so, you know, doing too much of one thing and giving up others probably also isn't a good idea. Although it's kind of increasingly the case that video games also provide a social link, not just a cognitive link. You know, lots and lots of games are played with others, whether they're simple games like Words with Friends or they're kind of massively multiplayer games where you play with hundreds of others.
Yeah. But some of those games, though, as you say, are not going to necessarily make you better in all areas, but they're going to make you better in maybe the area that you're playing. But that's still useful, isn't it?
Correct. And, you know, we tend to think of there being a progression. So when you first, say, start to play Sudoku, you might not know all the, we call them heuristics, basically the little rules that allow you to become good at Sudoku. So when you're first starting playing Sudoku, you are actually putting load on your cognitive system to kind of try to do planning. At some point, once you've learned kind of these heuristics, you stop relying on the cognitive system and you just kind of apply the rules. And so Sudoku early on might have benefits that you don't see as you've kind of learned all the rules. And pretty much any activity is like that. You know, so people doing crosswords, at some point you learn crossword words, right?
Yeah.
You know, I do lots of crosswords. I don't know what an urn is other than it's a bird that shows up in crosswords lots of times. And
bitter
so,
vetch, yeah. Urs, ERS.
Yeah, there's lots of these crossword words, right? And so once you've gotten to memorizing crossword words, you're probably not putting load on the cognitive system anymore. And so we tend to think that the best route is variety. So play, you know, if you're going to be using games as part of your kind of cognitive health, play a variety of them. Don't just play one and get super, super good at it. Try to do new things, right? And that will kind of keep everything fresh. It'll keep load on the cognitive system.
A brain's, I think as I saw you, heard you say somewhere where brains are kind of lazy in a way. They don't want necessarily to work if they don't have to work.
Correct. That's we call that the lazy brain hypothesis. If we can figure out some automatic rule that allows us to map between anytime I see bird in crossword, I try to jam urn in there without really thinking any further. That's what we'll try to do. And we automatize lots of skills. You know, we don't want to have to actually do planning and look ahead. It's cognitively expensive. So, you know, one demo I'll often do in my classes is I'll have people simulate what they would
do with their hands if they're trying to make a lane change while they're driving. And most people actually don't do it correctly. So let's say they're trying to move into the right-hand lane. They'll move their hands kind of clockwise, and then they'll go back to straight. In practice, that won't make a lane change. You actually have to go back a little bit the other way to remain straight. But we've more or less automatized this function when we're driving. We just use the visual input to directly map to our hands. We don't kind of do any of the look ahead or the cognitive processing. And, you know, that's what we tend to do lots of times. It's why the only way to keep load on the cognitive system is to constantly switch, basically not let your brain be lazy.
Kevin in Madison has something for us. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Seth. Love your show, Larry. Every day I learn something new, and I just it's great.
Thank you.
And I have something that I wanted to comment on that a previous caller, Jeremy, I think it was, that was talking about his son with autism.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to weigh in. I actually have a high-functioning autism, Asperger's syndrome, and I play video games, and something that I've learned about video games with being on the spectrum is, depending on the game, it actually brings out more of the socialness. It actually makes it so I can actually speak. It actually brings out more creativity. It also helps that my grandfather used to always wake me up at 5 a.m. in the morning and say, hey, let's do Scrabble. And I just wanted to say, bring that comment out, that it all depends on the video game, and it can definitely help people with autism, as you would say, bring out the social butterfly in them.
Oh, Kevin, thank you so much for calling. Sean, a comment from you.
Oh, I mean, I think that is consistent with what's known. So, for instance, you know, some games or really online communication can aid individuals who would otherwise feel uncomfortable in certain social situations. So, for instance, you know, if someone is an individual where direct social interaction is very uncomfortable, eye contact is very uncomfortable, this provides an opportunity to basically act through avatars. You know, it's not you. You're not being in the situation where you have to, say, read subtle facial cues. And so provides confidence that you can interact in a social environment. So I think there is, you know, some research to suggest exactly that.
I have a friend who gets up in the morning at 5 o'clock and plays a game with people from, I think there's one or two from Canada, from other states, and they play that game at 5 o'clock in the morning from 5 to 6 every morning. They play that game.
I mean, it's how I get, you know, so, you know, my younger brother lives in Florida. We don't have a relationship where we would necessarily call and talk on the phone about our lives, but we get almost all of our social interaction through playing games together. You know, we're playing, you know, and then we will chat about what's going on while we're in between things, something like that. So it certainly provides an interesting medium for social interaction.
Yeah. Kevin, again, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Is there something video game developers can do to combat potential negative effects of gaming?
So, I mean, I think with regard to addiction, you know, this is a really open question. So, you know, we have research in our lab suggesting that not all games show the same association with problem gaming. The directionality is obviously a very big problem in studying this topic. You know, are people who kind of naturally have a certain type of personality attracted to certain types of games, or do the games themselves provoke these behaviors? There's really no good way to tease that out. There's no ethical way to do an experiment where we assign people to certain games to see if they would become addicted to them, right? You can't do
that. No, you can't do that.
And so the best we can do is to try to, you know, parcel it out through kind of these long-term studies. But if nothing else, it seems like there are certain mechanics in games that are more associated with problem behavior. So there are undoubtedly kind of, you know, down to what we would call, you know, I teach intro psychology here at UW, and, you know, one of our classic psychology topics is operant conditioning, just using reinforcement and punishment to increase or decrease behaviors. And so there are undoubtedly ways that game designers could design games if they see problem behavior, if they see someone spending more money than they should, to combat that. And then it's a question of, you know, is that in the company's interest to do such a thing?
Yeah.
You know, with regard to the other major thing that people talk about with games is violence. And so, yeah. You know, that's another major concern for parents, and another place where the literature is kind of made difficult by the fact that we can't do ethical experiments. We can't kind yeah. of, you know, randomly assign someone to play a violent game and see if it turns them violent. But I would say the prevailing evidence suggests that, you know, there's no evidence that playing violent games actually produces what we call violent behaviors. Most of the research in social psychology focuses on things like aggressive thoughts. So, you know, is it easier for you to think of an aggressive word than a non-aggressive word? You know, and so the distance between that and actual criminal behavior is kind of so great that there's not really strong links there, despite the kind of more popular belief that there's this kind of really strong link between playing violent video games and kind of violent criminal behavior.
The action games, though, are pretty much, I mean, they're violent most.
Correct. You know, there's lots of violence in there. The question is whether that will produce any kind of real world violence in a person,
yeah.
right? And so we have layers and layers of cognitive control that allow us to recognize the context that we're in, for instance. You know, am I in a video game context or am I not in a video game context? And given that context, what types of behaviors are and are not acceptable? We do this all the time, right? You know, so someone who's in a karate class recognizes that certain types of behaviors are acceptable that wouldn't be acceptable on the bus, right?
Yeah.
And so in the same way that we have that layer of control, you know, recognizing this as a karate class or a bus, we have layers of control that allow us to recognize whether this is a video game or not a video game. And so really the points of concern are, say, you know, people who maybe don't have that layer of control, which
yeah.
can happen. Or there's certainly social psychologists who argue just the ease of access to kind of aggressive emotions or thoughts can be damaging in and of itself. So if someone bumps you in the hall, do you automatically respond with the thought that they did it on purpose? Mm-hmm. And you kind mm-hmm. of activate the fight or flight response? Or do you get bumped in the hall and assume that, you know, accidents happen, right?
Yeah. Well, couldn't the reverse also be true, as a, it could be a release for people?
So I would say lots of people have tested that. There's really no good evidence for kind of that hypothesis that this provides an outlet for violent thoughts. You know, it's one that has been examined, and, you know, there's certainly correlations between, you know, people who tend to have more aggressive thoughts and play more aggressive games.
Yeah.
But it's not clear that the games then provide an outlet for the behaviors.
Interesting. Patricia in La Crosse, we'll go to you next. Thank you for calling, Patricia. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I was going to make some comments to
yeah.
your guest. Actually, I'm always a little bit hesitant about hearing people talk about activities for people with disabilities or people who are aging. I've been in the field of therapeutic recreation for a really long time, and I've been teaching therapeutic recreation at UWL and up at Winona State. And what he's saying is really hits a nail on the head, because we're just not interested in the cognitive aspects of any type of activity, if you're going to use an activity for therapeutic purposes. But it's not just the cognitive, but the social and emotional and physical, that whole holistic kinds of things. I would make a comment also about the social parts of some activities. If you're playing bingo, that's really a one-on-one thing. You're just interacting with your board. It's not social. But you can make bingo social by having people interact with their neighbors. Same thing with watching a television or a football game on television. So it's really one-on-one, but if you can set up the situation where somebody is more social and doing things next to each other. So I like what you're talking about. We're experimenting a bit with people with dementia and using visual reality goggles, and they really, really love it. It's just another tool in the toolbox. It's not a fix-all for everything.
No.
But great. Thank you very much to your speaker. I hope he can maybe find out a little bit more. The literature in therapeutic rec might help.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Comment, Sean?
No, I mean, I think it sounds very consistent with, you know, the way that we think best practices are. There's actually some interesting cohort effects where certain age groups will treat, say, online social interactions more or less similarly to in-person interactions. So, for instance, you know, take the generation younger than me. They more or less treat texting as equivalent to conversations. You know, it all gets lumped as social interactions. My parents' generation, on the other hand, might not treat texting as exactly the same as having an in-person conversation. And so there are those kind of cohort effects in terms of how can you use technology to, you know, benefit socialness. Can you use online communication, and will that replace an in-person conversation? Might very well depend both on the cohort and the individual.
What kinds of games do you think are helpful for children, just in general?
I would say, you know, exploration-y kinds of games, games that allow them to explore, you know, new worlds, to kind of encounter new types of information. I do Big Brothers, Big Sisters. The kind of games that I would encourage my little to play would be those, kind of big open world. There's interesting research on the extent to which games can build self-efficacy, like beliefs about self-efficacy, that you are capable of succeeding in lots of unique mm-hmm. environments. And then also just, again, variety. I'd want them to, you know, do lots of different things. Really, childhood is a time when your brain is most plastic. It's most susceptible mm-hmm. to change. And so variety is really key there. You know, you want, there's old research actually starting in rats on enriched environments and the value of kind of more, you know, sources of information and more things to do being useful for brain development.
Yeah, very interesting. And what about adults?
Pretty much the same. we're less plastic, we're less susceptible to change, but the same types of things that are valuable in adults are invaluable in children tend to be valuable in adults. We're capable of less drastic changes in our behavior, but it doesn't mean that there's no possibility, right? We know that there's the possibility for brain plasticity and learning all the way through the lifespan. It's not equivalent at every stage of the lifespan, but it's possible at every stage of the lifespan.
So what's next for the Learning and Transfer Lab?
One of our major projects is basically to try to understand what specific aspects of games are and are not important in kind of producing cognitive benefits. You know, if you take an off-the-shelf commercial video game, there are many, many components in those. And it's unclear which ones are actually kind of causal driving agents and which ones are irrelevant. And so better understanding that would allow us to kind of more purposefully build games for impact.
This has been very interesting, Sean. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Will you come back and be with us again sometime?
For sure. And I'd say I'm also part of the UW Speakers Bureau that connects groups throughout Wisconsin with speakers at the UW. We come out and give talks for free. So if people are interested in that, they can look up the University of Wisconsin Speakers Bureau.
No, that's a great resource. Sean, thank you so much. Look forward to another visit. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Green is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking with him about video games and what they do to brain function. It's some pretty cool stuff. Some pretty cool stuff as well has to do with food. And what about diabetes? Diabetes-friendly dishes for one person. So you live alone, or do you spend time alone where you're having to do some cooking? We'll talk about that next with our guest here on the Ideas Network.